you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Paul and Philip Collins back on the show. They are the authors of The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship. They have recently read an article there. So I don't know how recent it was. The article was Alien Smokescreen. And not a very long piece, but it covered a lot of material in it. So I thought it was worthy of a discussion. They kindly agreed to come back on the show. Paul and Phil, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Tim. Not bad.
Now, this article, you're saying you're going to, of course, you're expanding upon it in your book you're working on. That book is the Invoking the Beyond. Is that what it is? Or?
Yeah, that's correct. That's okay. The working title.
The working title. And so this is going to factor into your book. So if maybe we can get the listeners a sample of what the book will be like when it indeed does come out. The Alien Smokescreen. Let's get into this. You talk about ufology, psychological warfare, Barry Seal, Area 51, CIA, arms, drug smuggling. So it's a lot to cover here. So let's wade into it.
Okay, we start the article by looking at a quote unquote documentary that came out some time ago called Area 51, the Alien Interview. It came out, I want to say, around 1997, and it really, really helped to reinvigorate a lot of the mythology, the UFO mythology surrounding, be more precise, the alien mythology surrounding Area 51, which is this top secret testing facility out in the middle of the Nevada desert. And the film, this documentary presents this film with this, which it's alleged footage of an alien inside what's called inside what the narrator refers to as a biocontainment area, and it runs for about 2 minutes and 55 seconds, and it's completely silent. And documentary includes this individual by the name of Victor on it, who explains what it is that we're seeing, and he is supposedly a whistleblower from Area 51, And he's claiming that he has that his motives are to basically tell people the truth about what's going on out there. And this was at that time at that time this was one of the latest in a series of disinformation pieces that were put out to the public to hide some of what was really going on at Area 51. And that's why the article is called Alien Smokescreen, because the myth, the alien myth, the stories of the fantastic stories of extraterrestrials seem to have been concocted to act as a smokescreen to hide, you know, some of the real activity that was going on out there.
Yeah,
and some of that activity is I guess you would consider benign, in the respect that they're just testing high altitude vehicles that they're not ready to reveal to the public. There's a national security umbrella there that's actually legitimate, that we don't need the nation's enemies knowing about these craft. But there's other things that the alien smokescreen acts to conceal. And one of those things we go into is from the records of the Federal Aviation Administration. And all the FAA has records concerning a C-123K cargo plane that was shot down over Nicaragua, and inside the plane, it was discovered by the Sandinistas. Daniel Ortega was the president at that time, and the Sandinistas had come into power. This was after Somoza had been deposed. They found arms that were intended for the Contras, but they also discovered logs, flight logs, and these flight logs linked that plane to Area 51. And you look into the background of this plane. The plane was leased by Southern Air Transport. Southern Air Transport was a CIA front, and all. The surviving member of the plane, Eugene Hassenfuss, who would go on to some infamy later as a cross dresser or something of that nature, and lost the better part of his mind. He was a cargo handler for the Central Intelligence Agency. And, you know, his admissions would help to really start to heat things up in terms of the scandal that's now known today as the Iran-Contra scandal. And you then look back at the plane's original owner, and you find out that it was Barry Seal. And there's a movie that's coming out here in the near future starring Tom Cruise concerning Barry Seal. And
it's already out. Yeah.
Oh, is it now?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
I saw it last week.
Gotcha. My understanding is that it's going to go into the fact that he was probably one of the most successful drug smugglers in American history, but it really doesn't present the fact that Seal was working for the Central Intelligence Agency. And the popular myth is that Seal was killed by a gangland hit because he was supposedly intending turning over on the Ochoa crime family. But in truth, Seal really had no fear of the Colombians. He really didn't have any kind of fear of the cartels. He didn't have any intentions of really saying anything that would be potentially damning in that regard, or do any kind of damage to the cartels. He was going to, however, roll over on George Bush. And we in the article, we go into the fact that the assassins secured legal counsel, and that the legal counsel was able to find out that they had been hired not by the cartels, but by a quote unquote gringo colonel. And that gringo colonel was Oliver North. And so what Area 51, the stories surrounding the Area 51, what they really acted to do was serve as fantastic disinformation that would distract away from the fact that SEAL's plane had been out there. And so Area 51 has in some part played a role in CIA connected drug smuggling, in particular CIA connected drug smuggling that was related to Iran-Contra, and related to specifically to the Contra war. It's now been shown that that Gary Webb had made a sound case for the hypothesis that the Southern Front Contras, Eden Pastora, Comandante Ciro, had received their money, had received money from CIA connected drug smugglers and drug dealers, and that the financing of the attempt to destabilize Daniel Ortega's Nicaragua was done through the selling of drugs on the streets of South Central Los Angeles, and that guys like Freeway, Ricky Ross, who were presented to the public as the kingpins of the drug trade, that had watched Scarface and decided this would be a cool thing to do. And all that, really, Freeway, Ricky Ross, and others were merely bottom feeders who were unwittingly working for the CIA. They didn't know that they were CIA surrogates, but that's essentially what they were, because the money was going back from Ross to Nicaraguan exiles, individuals who had been aristocracy during the Somoza era, and they were in turn providing the money back to Eden Pastora and to the other Contra leaders, and these Nicaraguans were protected by the CIA and were considered CIA assets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned American Made, this movie that came out earlier this fall, and it portrays Barry Seals being recruited in 1978 by the CIA to ship arms down to Central America to fight the CIA's war against the Sandinistas.
I haven't got to see the movie yet, mm-hmm. but I will tell you right now that that's inaccurate, because he had actually gone to work for the CIA shipping guns to Castro in Cuba, mm-hmm. and Barry Seal. So, I mean, his his relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency actually went back a lot further.
Mm-hmm.
It stretched back to the 1960s.
Yeah, Operation 40, right?
Yeah. Operation 40. The whole removal of Batista from power. Batista had been an asset of the American power elite, and then he was deemed a liability at a certain point. He shifted from being an asset to a liability class, and they decided to kick him out in favor of Castro, who would, you know, in turn get become a double cross. He went Barry Seal's legacy as an intelligence operative.
Yeah, activity also in Vietnam, Air America. And in 1972, he was arrested for smuggling explosives.
Right, yeah. Right, absolutely.
And yeah, I believe it's Daniel Hopsinger who wrote the definitive book on Barry Seal, Barry and the Boys. He has that wonderful photo cover where there's all those Operation 40 guys in Mexico City in, I think, November 60, or January 63, I think, somewhere abouts. And, of course, you see a picture of a young Porter Goss, and behind a young Porter Goss appears to be Barry Seal, yeah.
Yeah, we all owe Hopsinger a debt of gratitude in that respect, because he found out that was Porter Goss that appeared in the picture.
Mm-hmm. Who later became a congressman, then director of Central Intelligence.
Right. Right. In the book, we point out that aliens and UFOs are presented as disinformation to cover up elite deviancy, to cover up intelligence crimes. We also try to point out that as far as drugs are concerned, they cover the whole alien mythos acts to conceal Central Intelligence Agency's involvement in the global drug trade, and the involvement of other Western intelligence organs in the global drug trade. But drugs and aliens are drugs and alien disinformation are both part of an overarching agenda of control. And if you look at both drugs and at the alien mythos, both are tools of social engineering. The drugs inject docility and suggestibility into a population, break down the collective will, break down the individual will, and make people more pliable, make people more controllable. MK Ultra is a good example of this, and then with the alien mythos, it changes what people believe. It brings about a change in people's beliefs, and it displaces traditional belief systems, Orthodox Christian beliefs. And replaces them with belief systems that allow for more manipulation of the population.
The alien thing. It's a way to supplant traditional Christian belief and replace it with an ersatz religion, because these alien beings often presented as, you know, angelic or superior.
Well, And when we say the alien myth, when we invoke the term myth and mythology, we're invoking it only in the pejorative sense that it's occurred in recent history and modernity. We're not talking about myths in the traditional and transcendent sense. Myths in the traditional and transcendent sense were narratives that basically underscored truths and realities beyond themselves. Mm-hmm. And also, they also helped to illustrate certain realities of Orthodox Christianity, albeit beneath layers of embellishment and distortion. And some of the early church fathers, such as Saint Justin Martyr, point this out, that many of the pagan beliefs, many of the pagan myths, and you know, many of the pagan philosophies actually elucidate certain truths that he would have considered the intellectual property first of Orthodox Christianity. And he refers to these as the spermatogos logos, or the seeds of the word, the seeds of Christ, which are made evident in these old pagan philosophies and these pagan myths. For instance, you have with the tales of Prometheus, you actually have something of a heavily embellished and distorted version of the fall of Lucifer. Mm-hmm. And you also have admonitions against hubris. You have kind of a cautionary tale against the hubris of autotheism, of asserting oneself against the divine. So myths in the traditional and transcendent sense actually have a legitimate place in human belief systems. They define who we are. They establish for us our position in the cosmos. Cultural anthropologists have also noted that certain creation myths correspond with particular societal models that are basically enshrined. And so depending upon the creation myth that you subscribe to, that is a significant determinant in the societal model that defines your civilization. And what you have with the alien myth is a radically redefined creation myth, because no longer does man originate with a transcendent creator who is outside of the spatio-temporal universe, who is transcending the ontological confines of the physical cosmos, but instead you have man as being something of an experiment.
Was it Watson or Crick, the DNA guy?
Sir Francis Crick.
Crick, who postulates little green men.
Yeah, guided panspermia, as he calls it, and
doesn't offer anything from an explanatory standpoint, because then who created them?
Yeah, exactly. You have and see that's really just with this new creation myth of alien gods. You have basically tacit credence being paid to the scientific materialist position that all that exists is the result of an infinite regress of finite material causes, which really diminishes an explanatory power when you examine it, because you have a series of finite material causes causing one after another, an infinite succession, and the question remains, well, where is the ultimate point of origin?
Yeah, it's turtles all the way down, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And exactly. That's a very good point. And this all is in conformity with the modern myth of evolution, of Darwinism, which Wolfgang Smith identifies as a Gnostic myth, because it basically affirms the soteriological position of self-salvation, a Gnostic soteriological position, with the metaphysical claim of self-creation. All is the result of the causa sui cosmos. It all originates from what Darwin referred to as the tree of life. And like its ancient antecedents, this new myth populates the heavens with a pantheon of gods and titans. The identity and nature of these deities is intimated by none other than Richard Dawkins, who contends that Darwin's evolutionary narrative, in his words, quote, is not merely incidentally true of our kind of life, but almost certainly true of all life everywhere in the universe, unquote. So in other words, the same evolutionary processes that produce the diverse life on Earth are at work elsewhere in the universe. The intermundane divinity that Darwin dubbed the tree of life extends its branches throughout the entire physical cosmos. And those planets that are fortunate enough to come into contact with limbs from this pantheistic tree will birth life from primordial soups of their own. And basically, Rupert Sheldrake reiterated this point when he said that all of nature, in his words, all of nature is evolutionary. And he basically states that the cosmos is one enormous developing organism, that it's this one organismic divinity. And on this view, the universe is quite literally alive. But you have with this depiction of the universe, you have with this creation, this particular creation myth, you have a view of all things basically laying, attributing their origins to divine homogeneity, this causa sui universe. It's basically an emanatized version of the Gnostic Pleroma, from which all existence supposedly emanated. But what is basically implied through that creation myth is that all things once were occupied this homogeneous state of being, and all things returned to it. And so the political system intimated through that creation myth is collectivism.
Yeah.
And so returning to the cultural anthropologist's assertion that creation myths define civilization, well, that's what this new creation myth is doing. It's redefining human civilization as one enormous societal pleroma, in a sense. All things are returning to it, and the societal model that's insinuated is one of collectivism.
But we already pointed out how the alien myths related to Area 51 have acted as a cover for possibly illegal, possibly that facility's involvement in intelligence connected drug operations. The CIA's involvement in the global drug trade. Well, those alien myths related to Area 51, the way that they play into the religious engineering can be seen again through this quote unquote whistleblower Victor that appeared in that 97 documentary. He reemerged a few years later and said, and basically claimed in an interview that our bodies are mainly or essentially just containers for souls. And he said that he was going to die soon, and that basically he was going to be shuffling off the container. Bob Lazar, Robert Lazar. We talked about him in a previous interview. But Robert Lazar, who claimed to have been out at Area 51, and he was out at Area 51. It's obvious there's no way that he could have known the flight times the way he did or had the details that he had. But it's also clear that he was lying about his educational background. So he probably had a what is known in the intelligence world as a legend that was put together for him by intelligence circles. He also claimed that there were aliens out at the S-4 site in Area 51, and that these aliens had revealed to the human the scientist out there that bodies are nothing more than containers for souls. And this is pure Gnosticism. That is pure Gnostic, right? You have with this assertion, this very low view of physical embodiment, which Orthodox Christianity identifies as fundamental to human identity. Orthodox Christianity basically asserts that humanity is a composite, something of a heliomorphic composite of both body and soul, and they're both intertwined, and neither one should be elevated to the detriment of the other. However, with Gnosticism, what Gnosticism did was it conflates the curse with creation. It views all of the all the present afflictions of the flesh. It views all of those as a natural consequence of creation, and in so doing, it views creation itself, it views the ontological confines of the physical universe as being inherently ontologically deficient. And so you have this very docetistic cosmological attitude, and you'll find this in many or Gnosio-Hermetic text. You'll find this view of the cosmos. Sometimes it's overtly unflattering. It's overtly contemptuous. At other times, it's tacitly affirming of the physical universe. However, the physical universe is still regarded only as the receptacle of some incorporeal good, and that receptacle is eventually meant to be jettisoned. But this is the overall hermeneutic that defines the alien myth. That hermeneutic is a Gnostic one. And whenever you see these Gnostic elements in the alien myth, it's kind of a giveaway that there has been manipulation on the part of elite deviants, because Gnosticism has been incorporated into the global oligarchical establishment. It actually began to find a prominent place in the beliefs among elites going all the way back to the Cathar heresy. And you know, some people just think that the Cathar were this poor marginalized sect in southern France and places like Languedoc. You know, that they were just mercilessly hunted down and slaughtered by the church. But in truth, they, much of their membership included the merchant class and the trader class, you know, embryonic capitalist, because it basically recognized the physical world as the negative or bad principle, and the spirit as the positive principle. And so And so there was no prohibition in the Cathar belief system against usury, because the physical world was a negative and dark and bad thing. And so exploiting it through usury and through usurious practices was no crime. And that's why it was very attractive to traders and merchants, as opposed to the medieval church, as opposed to Christian Europe, which had a strong, very strong prohibition on usury.
Now, does this factor in things like the Talmud?
The Talmud does factor in, you know. The Cathar, it was a mixture of some Eastern mysticism in terms of their beliefs in reincarnation, and a lot in terms of Gnosticism, because you know the physical world was a negative, bad principle. It was the bad principle created by a dark god, a demiurge, and spirit was the good principle, and humanity represented the crossroads between those two principles.
This Michael Hoffman's writes that it was around the 13th or 14th century that this infested the Catholic Church. The principle of usury, or the gradual acceptance of a succession of popes. And he calls it the occulted Catholic Church now, which it's been, roughly since the 15th century, with the Renaissance.
Unfortunately, there's been a gradual migration in that direction by the Catholic Church, but Western Christianity, generally speaking. The Eastern Church, represented by the Orthodox and by the Byzantium, seems to have avoided much of that.
It also follows roughly the contours along with the British Freemasonry and the British Empire.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But you get up to today with Pope Francis, and he has said that basically that spiritual acts of mercy that aren't accompanied by corporal acts of mercy are worthless, and thus erasing the validity of spiritual acts of religious devotion, like such as prayer and whatnot. It basically, when you say something like that, you're on the way of to changing what you believe into nothing more than a social gospel, and changing your followers, transforming them from disciples of Christ to just nothing more than cheap social justice warriors.
Yeah, because there's no benefit in benedictions and things like that.
But I mentioned that this Gnostic hermeneutic defines the alien myth, the modern alien myth.
Mm-hmm.
And really, interestingly enough,
is this what aliens always appear to be? Like asexual or androgynous?
Yes. They always appear to be androgynous, which in Gnostic soteriology is considered to be a form of salvific union. And I believe we actually discussed that in an earlier interview with you concerning feminism.
All the sexual confusion is being promoted today by the corporate media.
The iconography of several secret societies that acted as elite conduits. There's a lot of insect iconography in those secret societies, and insects no gender.
Fable of bees, right?
Right, exactly. And I mean, you have that with the LGBTIXYZQ alphabet soup now, because, you know, don't you know, you can really choose whatever gender you happen to be. Inherent in that is the Gnostic belief that there is absolute human plasticity, that there are no determinants of identity, gender being one of them. And underpinning that particular belief, again, is this docetistic attitude towards physical embodiment, which is extrapolated further into a docetistic cosmological attitude regarding the physical universe, because the possession of sex organs is an entailment of physical embodiment, which Gnostics absolutely derided that condition. They held in contempt the status of physical embodiment. They held in contempt all materiality. And again, that stems from this misidentification of the point of origin of evil. Again, the Gnostics bestowed ontological being upon evil. They projected evil outside of the intangible will, which Orthodox Christianity identifies as evil's point of origin. Evil originates not with our nature, because actually when you sin, when you act in evil, you are acting in contrary to your nature. To assert otherwise would be to fall into the Masothism that St. Basil the Great warns against, because St. Basil the Great says, well, if you're going to ascribe to evil substance and form, if you're going to ascribe to an ontological being, that results, in his words, in a rebound of blame to the creator. And that's precisely what took place with the Gnostics. They ascribed ontological being towards to evil, and so that resulted in a rebound of blame to the creator, and it resulted in Masothism. And by the way, for those who think that this is exclusively a Christian critique of Gnosticism, that is not so. Plotinus also advanced the same criticisms of Gnosticism. He said that it was it arrived at this erroneous Masothism because of its failure to identify the true point of origin of evil, which is actually the disordered will. But what happens when you refuse to acknowledge the intangible will as the point of origin of all evil, you project that evil outside of the will onto the tangible world. And you see this very Gnostic mentality endemic to the political left, because what do they always blame? They blame everything that's external to them for the woes of man. So you have this seek and destroy mentality, the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on the war on the lack of education. It's always something external to man. And you know, you have this very same sort of ideas being promoted with Enlightenment theoreticians such as Rousseau. Rousseau asserted that civilization was a corrupting force upon humanity, that humanity and the human will was not the point of origin for all evil. Instead, it must be civilization. You have it with Karl Marx. Karl Marx asserting that it was private property. There's always this external corruption that must be extinguished, and that's why with the revolutionary, you always have this this very docetistic proclivity towards the disfiguration of external reality, because you're constantly advancing these seek and destroy campaigns against everything that is external to you. So in the case of the Marxist, private property had to be abolished. The bourgeoisie had to either be re-educated or destroyed. In the case of the feminist, it's patriarchy must be destroyed. This chimerical male dominated conspiracy, whatever the heck that is. You know, but it's always something that's external to man, and that's the Gnostic mentality that pervades the socio-political utopian mind.
But it's interesting also that Phil points out, you know, this misidentification of the origin of evil, because it brings us back to the issue of drugs that we explored in the article. You know, the misidentification of evil is actually proves to be very advantageous to the elite, especially because one of the things that they identify.
That's what you say, Marx, you know, bomb throwing anarchist or revolutionary Marxist or social justice warriors or social engineers are instruments for the oligarchs.
The oligarchs. And all, and you know, going back to the topic of drugs that we explored in the article and we explore in the book, the oligarchs by distracting away from the intangible will as the source, and focusing everybody's attention on drugs as the source has allowed them to build up a war on drugs, and Jim Keith, who's deceased now, pointed out he was a researcher back in the 90s. He pointed out that, you know, you have this process where several things are going on simultaneously. Over here, there is legislation that's being passed that criminalizes drugs, that's anti-drug in nature, and turns the user and the foot soldier, that just a small-time dealer on the street, into the enemy, the source of all evil. This is the source of evil, and all. But then over here, the very same forces over here. The exact same forces that are creating that legislation are also cultivating the trade in illegal drugs. Mm-hmm. So by doing this, as Keith pointed out, you had a rationalization for the war on drugs, and the war on that led, in turn, the war provided a pretext for police penetration of society and the suppression of political freedoms.
Yeah, because you simply cannot uphold or respect the Constitution in an environment where you're waging a drug war, because we see it in asset forfeiture laws, no-knock raids, the denial of due process, and these things are simply shredded in this war on drugs.
Yeah. Exactly. So, again, the drug trade and the alien mythos that acts as disinformation to conceal the involvement of oligarchic forces in that drug trade and all, both of those elements.
Yeah, in the article you actually quote Jim Keith, which I think it's worth.
Yeah.
Jim Keith, in Case Book on Alternative 3, writes, "There is a war going on worldwide which at one level has nothing to do with drugs, although it can be sold to the public, particularly the American public, on the basis of suppression of drugs, simultaneously creating anti-drug legislation and fostering drug trade, mirroring operation that took place in America during the Prohibition. International manipulators obtain both a rationalization for that war and for the increased police penetration of society and suppression of political freedom. The fundamental game is not traffic in drugs, but the traffic in human lives and energy, the buying, selling, and herding of cattle resources. It boils down to the ultimate master-slave relationship, with the master in the continual struggle for profits and to keep the people uninformed, sated, mindless, utilized. The host, be it animal, human, or planet, is anesthetized, then drained by its parasitic self-styled master. and then the Ravaged Hulk is discarded. So,
I couldn't put it more eloquent. Yeah. So, but you know, again, what this shows is that both the global drug trade and the alien mythos that conceals the involvement of oligarchic forces in that drug trade, both the alien myth and the drug trade are merely part of merely elements, parts of an overarching control agenda.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
What I was going to say was that during the Iran-Contra period of America's hidden history, that control agenda found embodiment in Oliver North's network of gunrunners and drug traffickers known mm-hmm. as the Enterprise. Yeah. There was an abundance of UFO disinformation swirling around aspects of the Contra war and the Iran-Contra scandal, and swirling around the Enterprise, and it seemed that this really toxic confection made up of UFO disinformation, illegal gun running, drug trafficking, it found its way into the control agenda that claimed the Enterprise as its major patron saint, and the Enterprise was no small thing. I mean, if you look back to the report of the congressional committees investigating the Iran-Contra affair, you find and you go into those records and you read them, you find out that by 1986, Richard Secord. Running that organization at the behest of Oliver North and all, controlled five aircraft, a C-7 transport. They had an airfield in one country. They had warehouse facilities at an air base in another, a stockpile of guns and military equipment they would pipeline to the Contras. They had secure communications equipment that they had gotten from the National Security Agency. And you're talking about a really, really, really elaborate infrastructure here. You know that these stories, these, you know, weird stories of aliens were in part helping to conceal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
And as far as you're talking about the drug trade and how it factors into the political process and also the economy as well, Dana Hopsicker is writing about Barry Seal. And Barry Seal was caught smuggling the explosives. He says, well, the explosives were probably being shipped out to obtain heroin. There was being, I guess, ultimately finding its way to the Gambino crime family. But this also is in the context of when Richard Nixon was starting his war on drugs, which was trying to get control of the drug enforcement, sort of trying to nudge out the CIA, which probably factors into the Watergate scandal. And,
yeah, many of the people that came on board for DEA, which was supposed to be Nixon's, that was Nixon's attempt to counter the CIA
mm-hmm.
and to push them out. Many of those people from that came on board, the staff, the DEA were CIA. So you could see where Nixon was getting ready to have the screws put down.
Yeah, I think Kruger's book, The Cocaine Coup, details that.
Yeah, Henrik Krieger's the great heroin coup.
Yeah, the great heroin coup. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
The great heroin coup, because that was the time when I guess the Bureau of Narcotics was shut down. The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs was then succeeded it, but then that was shut down because every time they're investigating a narcotics trafficking, they'd run up against intelligence operations, and it'd be shut down every time you get above the street level. And so what happened was the DEA was formed. The DEA was gradually infiltrated with CIA. And if you follow Doug Valentine's work in Strength of the Wolf, Strength of the Pack, he details the history of counter narcotics operations in the United States. Which really happens by the 1980s, he says DEA was pretty much taken over by the CIA to the point where now it's there to manage the drug trade and facilitate approved cartels, approved drug channels, and shut down all the others, you know, in classic monopoly capitalist form.
Right, you know? Absolutely. Right.
But he even says, like, the $1 million that Richard Nixon and John Dean are talking about to help the Watergate burglars is Hopsinger speculates that was money from the drug trade, cash.
Correct.
Yeah. So it's very interesting.
Oh, absolutely.
$1 million. We can do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But you know, with the Enterprise, you know, North and Albert Akeem and Secord's Enterprise, you see its involvement in the control agenda that alien mythos and drug running are merely elements of.
Well, I mean, with Gary Webb, I mean, Gary Webb didn't get into this. He just exposed the trafficking, the facilitation of drugs being cocaine being imported into L.A. and subsequently being free-based or refined into crack cocaine, creating a cheap drug. But others have speculated on a more of a social engineering, a more sinister thing. There was an intent to degrade to those societies for human harvesting. But because a lot of the money that went into the that was sold in those areas was laundered through outfits like Death Row Records. Which promoted the rap culture, the drug culture, the magazine, Spin Magazine. You know, the Los Angeles Police Department infiltrated by CIA, and that's, you know, you get the Rampart scandal, all this stuff, and how they wanted to actually antagonize the gang activity, not just to keep the channels, the trade for drugs and guns, but also to more or less create a high crime to justify what Jim Keith was talking about. Police state is sort of a strategy of tension.
Well, the Rampart Division scandal with that whole thing, it facilitated the rise of Mara Salvatrucha 13, MS-13. And, you know, there's been a considerable amount of research done that has shown that our State Department has basically created a revolving door for MS-13 in and out of the country.
Right. I actually wrote an article over that. The article was entitled Cultivating Criminality is what I think I entitled the article. It's also up at Conspiracy Archive.
Well, it's like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, right? These are assets.
You're right.
Yeah.
Right. And something else, I don't want to.
What's the name of that article? I'm sorry.
Cultivating Criminality. It's up at Conspiracy Archive. And what's fascinating about MS-13, we've been discussing, you know, the Gnostic elements of the war on drugs and what have you. And so there's clearly some substratum of this conspiracy that is occult in character. And I don't want to go too tangential, but what's interesting about MS-13 is you find a great deal of their iconography is satanic. They have pictures of demons. They give the
horn sign.
Blue
devil tattoos.
Yeah, blue devil tattoos.
The number 13.
And if I'm not mistaken, there was a recent article where two MS-13 members confessed to being practicing Satanist. And why is this, why is this significant? Well, you'll find with a great many revolutionary theoreticians, such as Bakunin, and, well, Karl Marx, there is this preoccupation with Satan. And while they
ultimate revolutionary.
Yeah, exactly. Proudhon also wrote a great deal on Satan. But there's throughout
this what's his name? You know, Ruse for Radicals.
Yeah, Saul Alinsky. He dedicates
his book to Satan. So yeah.
Right. Yeah. And there's not only this preoccupation with Satan, but there's also a preoccupation with the paganized version of Satan, which is Prometheus. As a matter of fact, James A. Billington refers to the revolutionary faith as the Promethean faith.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that they acknowledge Satan as a literal metaphysical entity. They don't believe that he literally exists, but they believe that Satan is actually a symbol of human cognitive faculties, which they have imbued with virtually deific qualities.
So we're back to Gnosticism, aren't we?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And you look at Gnosticism, you look at the hypostasis of the Archons, which is an ancient Gnostic Egyptian text. Mm-hmm. And in that, lo and behold, within the inverted hermeneutic of that particular narrative, the serpent is depicted as an incognito savior. So you have this inverted hermeneutic where Satan consistently assumes the role of a liberator. Now, I want to add that simply by the fact that you may not, you know, acknowledge the existence of Satan as a literal metaphysical entity, that doesn't mean that you can't act within his will, that you can't act within that you are nevertheless realizing realizing his vision.
Well, beliefs have existential consequences. Yes. Yeah. And that's just the way it is.
And there is endemic to the revolutionary faith a tacit autotheism. There's this belief that man is God. And that, again, is underpinned by an utterance, you know, that is made all the way back in a particular garden. somebody says, "Ye shall be as gods," and this deification stands in stark contrast to the Orthodox Christian doctrine, the soteriological doctrine of theosis, which holds that man gains union with God, but it's union without fusion. Man remains ontologically distinct from God. In contradistinction, this is apotheosis. This is deification by essence. This is where man actually displaces God. This is where man actually assumes all the qualities of divinity. And you have that autotheism pervading revolutionary doctrines. And I think that it's quite significant that you have this satanic iconography pervading the MS-13 movement, and it seems to be derivative of that revolutionary faith.
Is there any thing, I mean, you mentioned there's a satanic element to MS-13. It's a cult, obviously, gang or cult, whatever you want to call it. But historically, these satanic cults have been assets of intelligence agencies. This is a less of a esoteric or occulted explanation of what's going on, but these groups serve a practical use for these intelligence agencies, whether it's drug running, human trafficking. You mentioned the Gnostic idea that somehow that evil doesn't come from free will. It's a creation of God, and God can be blamed for the existence of evil. And that factored in, from what I understand, I'm not an expert, doesn't that factor also into the doctrines or beliefs of the Process Church, which, you know, if you look at it, you know, they seem to be somewhat of a, they seem to be assets of intelligence agencies or, you know, occulted, you know, secret societies or intelligence agencies, same thing, really. but they all seem to be kind of, they all have that basic belief, but they all end up being agents of these intelligence agencies or cult societies.
If you go back to some of the characters that we bring up in the article, Alien Smokescreen, we mm-hmm. brought up Colonel Oliver North. Well, there was evidence, there was a considerable amount of evidence that should not be discounted as part of satanic panic or just dismissed as part of that phenomenon, that that Colonel Michael Aquino, mm-hmm. who was the head of the satanic temple of Set, was a part of Oliver North's Contra support apparatus.
And if I may add, part and parcel of the theology of the Temple of Set is the belief in an extraterrestrial deity, which they called Pantechnicon. Mm-hmm. So once again, you have this nexus where CIA drug smuggling and the UFO alien myth intersect.
In Scientology, right?
Right, and in Scientology, Hubbard's Scientology is in essence Gnosticism, straight up Gnosticism. The belief is that we are actually nothing more than the receptacle for these alien spirits that were blown up in a volcano by Xenu,
who's basically a banana republic dictator in space,
right?
And since we're also Miles Copeland, who headed up the political action wing of the Central Intelligence Agency, he even admits in his book, I want to say the name of the book is The Game Player, that
Game of Nations, I think.
Well, I think it's
another book. Okay,
there's two books. I think the one that I'm thinking of, the one that I'm citing right now is The Game Player. There is the one, the Games Nations Play or something like that.
Okay.
To commercial time right now. Our friend Jay Dyer has done an excellent review of that.
Oh, yeah. I talked to him about it. Yeah.
Yeah. By all means, go and listen to his talk. Especially when he points out that there is truth in the report from Iron Mountain, that it's not just pure fiction, that it's probably a satire or something, it was written to reflect a reality, and in report from Iron Mountain there was the suggestion of a hoaxed alien invasion. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back on The Game Player, Miles Copeland had an assistant by the name of Bob Mandelstam, and Mandelstam and he started what was called OHP, which the project, this the acronym for this project, OHP, what it meant was Occultism in High Places. And what they did is they noted just how many heads of state, how many influential political figures and leaders relied on spiritual leaders, not that fell outside of the traditional religions, for their advice. They relied on soothsayers. They relied on tarot card readers. They relied on psychics, and so they decided that by controlling these people, by gaining these people as assets, they could indirectly control, leaders and political leaders and whatnot in countries abroad and also here in the United States. Well, as part of that
as part of that that project, the OHP project, they reached out to Scientology so, you know, that going back to your point about Scientology being having an intelligence connection there, well, there you go. It's from the camel's mouth right there. It's from Copeland himself.
And also one more personality that I think is significant in examining this occult substratum of the deviant elite conspiracy is none other than Carl Gustav Huhn. Carl Gustav Huhn, of course, popularized the theory of archetypes and what have you.
And he was friends with Alan Dulles, by the way.
Yeah.
And Henry Davidson, who was a nuclear physicist who worked on the I believe it was the Manhattan Project. He accused Dulles of helping to manufacture the UFO myth by turning to using Huhn's writings and using Huhn's idea of the archetype as a source of inspiration.
Yes, and actually in some of his later work, Huhn refers to the circular shape of the UFO as being archetypal, as being symbolic of divinity, which, once more, you have this belief that you know, aliens somehow constitute an immanent divinity from which human life sprung through experimentation. But Carl Gustav Huhn, in the early 50s, which was nearing the end of his career, became obsessed with UFOs, and he just read books like Flying Saucers from Outer Space, The Truth About Saucers, Flying Saucer Conspiracy. And interestingly enough, Carl Huhn also took a very early interest in none other than the Nag Hammadi Gospels, which were Gnostic texts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Huhn's longtime collaborator and friend, Professor Gillis Quispel, who assumed the chief role in the publication and translation of the Nag Hammadi books. And so you have this, preoccupation with UFOs, and it's the nexus where it intersects with Gnosticism as the chief hermeneutic according to which the extraterrestrial mythology is understood. And that mythology assumes two forms. One form that it assumes is where the aliens are essentially enlightened space brethren. They become something akin to the Sophia in Gnostic creation myths, where they impart gnosis to humanity. They are here to enlighten. And then there is another variant of that Gnostic hermeneutic that defines the alien mythos, where the extraterrestrials are basically archons. They are deceivers. They are the enemies of humanity, and they are attempting to prevent us from attaining gnosis.
Isn't that why Catholic bishops wore mitres to cover up their cone heads? Sorry.
No, that's quite all right. You know, in either case, though, whichever form this particular view of the aliens takes, it's either one proves to be expedient to the interest of the global oligarchical establishment. Because if the aliens happen to be evil archons attempting to prevent us from attaining gnosis, then you have an excellent rationale there for the amalgamation of all nation states into a single supranational entity, into a global government to oppose them. and you have this particular narrative being intimated through pop culture films such as Independence Day, mm-hmm. which is overtly a piece of globalist propaganda. If the aliens happen to be benevolent space brethren, well, then it stands to reason that no one nation state can speak for planet Earth. I think it was Stanton Friedman said, who speaks for Earth? Argentina? and so it becomes an excellent rationale, for global government. So whichever narrative paradigm governs the alien myth, both prove to be expedient to deviant elite interest.
Yeah. There was an article I came across talking about, there's a RAND study in 1950 called The Exploitation of Superstitions for the Purposes of Psychological Warfare. And this studied various examples in history of governments going in and exploiting local, superstitions to, facilitate dominion or control of that area. What this suggests is the alien, the sort of flying saucer meme or scare was concocted by the national security state. But this study from RAND doesn't say it did that, but it does suggest that such an approach would work. The paper discusses Soviet missions that successfully exploited local superstitions in Afghanistan in the 1920s by the British, the Germans doing something during World War II, projecting images on clouds. It doesn't say what the images were. You have the employment of, you mentioned, I guess Miles Copeland talks about this, the using fortune tellers and false astrological data to dampen the morale of the enemy, to manipulate foreign leaders. You mentioned that. But there was this guy
named Edward Lansdale.
Yeah, in the Philippines. Who was
Well, Lansdale was wanting to manufacture a kind of synthetic second coming of Jesus Christ as part of a coup to depose Castro.
Yeah, the imaging of the Holy Mother or Jesus on a cloud or something from a submarine.
And I know that over in Vietnam, when Colonel Michael Aquino was, I can't remember, the 306th or of something, with a psychological operation over there, with a psychological division over there, he was having helicopters fly above the cloud coverage and basically play these loudspeakers just playing like unearthly kind of demonic shrieks and basically to spook the hell out of the North Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. and these kind of attempts to manufacture an otherworldly or supernatural kind of event act as excellent resume builders and attract those intelligence circles that are involved in the UFO deception to these kind of individuals.
Yeah.
It becomes these kind of operations become the springboard for entering into what we call collectively the UFO deception.
You have the case of, I think, the documentary Mirage Men.
It's
very important because it shows, I guess there was someone from the Air Force infiltrating the ufology community,
Richard,
and really manipulating people. I mean, really almost driving them to the point of suicide, I believe, right?
Richard Doty, and believe it or not, he's back at it again because he now what Richard Doty is saying is that, well, I fed Paul Benowitz all this information, but I saw other film that was the truth, and here's the real truth of it, and enters into another weaving another tale of you know, alien visitation of Earth. And
right. And if I may also add, that actually segues into my next point. One of the people who was deceived and remains arguably deceived by Richard Doty was none other than Carol Malton Howe. And of course, he presented her with documents that basically implied that the human evolutionary process was facilitated by extraterrestrials. So once again, we have this myth of alien gods creating humanity. And it also asserts that Jesus Christ was, in essence, an extraterrestrial himself. So you have this notion of an exotheological Christ, which bears a great deal of resemblance to the Gnostic notions of Christ as an exemplar. But interestingly enough, with Carol Malton Howe, you have in her a great example of how the promulgation of the alien myth actually encourages drug use, because Carol Malton Howe once tried to convince our friend Michael Corbin, the host of the nationally syndicated radio talk show A Closer Look. He passed away in 2008, I believe it was.
Yeah, it was 2008.
Yeah, she tried to encourage him to take acid and hang out in Machu Picchu, because don't you know, you drop acid, you're going to see these UFOs. You probably see a lot of other stuff too. But
yeah, you will see UFOs.
Yeah, you'll probably, you know, flip and see, you know, Elvis, you know, and Michael Jackson, you know, flying in a chariot or something. Yeah. But the point is that now you have an excellent rationale for, you know, the promotion of further drug usage, and not just of any drug, but acid, LSD.
Yeah, this is the same way that back in the 60s, when these rock groups like the Beatles were promoting Eastern mysticism, at the same time promoting drugs that you could get a higher inner reality through.
Right. Yeah. Well, and hint, hint, wink, wink, nod, nod, MK Ultra.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, oh boy, what was I going to say? Actually, Richard Doty was either an intermediary for or a participant in what William Moore called the aviary, which was a collection of supposedly disgruntled intelligence officers from different intelligence entities in the United States government that wanted to give the American public the truth. And the reason they were called the aviary is because each one of the members were not known by their real name.
Well, I mean, this is interesting, because this goes to the point about that Rand paper back in 1950, identifying a community or society's prejudices, superstitions or vulnerabilities, because what they're doing is, a while back I finished a book by Wendy S. Painting, The Secret Lies of Timothy McVeigh. It's called Aberration in the Heartland of the Real, Secret Lies of Timothy McVeigh. It gets into the, not just himself, but the sort of the cultural milieu that he developed, and explaining his personality. Also just the complex tale of Timothy McVeigh and what went into Oklahoma City. And it's a wonderful book, by the way. I highly recommend it. But she gets into, he got into ufology, and there's some question on what Timothy McVeigh was. Was he an agent? Was he an asset? You know, was he sheep dipped or whatever? But he got into ufology, but she describes the ufology community. And this is something that someone like the, you're mentioning, we're recognizing a vulnerability in American society, perhaps in the 70s and 80s, that have been demoralized largely.
I just want to read
this one section here. Sure. It goes, Thomas E. Bliard, writing about UFO abductions, reports in 1989, identified narrative similarities in the sightings and abduction accounts and traditional folk stories. About visitors such as devils, angels, demons, fairies, human excursions into mythological underworlds. For him, This indicated that the abductee and the citizen research groups initially became attracted to the UFO abduction scenario because it offered a language with which to express a deeply human yearning for a larger unseen reality. Kimberly Ball is one of the number of commentators who assert that UFOs and alien abduction stories indicate millennial anxieties over an anticipated hyper-technological future, so seemingly futuristic, it appears alien. The stories told help augment the lack of a framework with which to conceive of, let alone discuss, rapid technological developments that will inevitably transform society and humanity itself. Christopher Roth, in his 2005 essay, Ufology as Anthropology, Race, Extraterrestrials, and the Occult, adeptly demonstrates that shared intellectual roots, belief structures, and discursive practices between ufology and science, anthropology, religion, and mysticism generally. For him, the crossover are most salient in relations to the issue of race. Put simply, wrote Roth, ufology is one sense of all about race, and it has more to do with terrestrial racial schemes as social and cultural constructs than most UFO believers are aware. Roth argues that UFO discourse is nearly inseparable from existing but older anthropological discourses that had legitimized a hierarchical racial and class order. The aliens resemble anthropologists, zoologists, and entomologists who abduct, examine, tag, release hapless human specimens back into their natural habitat. The question that preoccupies ufology, says, is the role that humans will play in what appears to be an unfolding of an interplanetary, interracial drama. Sorry for the long quote, but I thought that was relevant to what we're talking about here.
Well, yeah, I know Phil's dying to share something here, but I got to get in on this right here. And we're opening up a whole big can of worms, and we won't possibly be able to eat them all. But let me say this. We go into Timothy McVeigh in the manuscript. Okay. Timothy McVeigh was involved with Elohim City.
Mm-hmm.
Elohim City was a Christian identity commune.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right.
I think I know where you're going.
Yeah. Ran by Reverend Robert Millar, who later admitted to this in the Tulsa, Oklahoma court, FBI informant, and the security guard for the head of security for Elohim City was a man by the name of Andreas Strassmeyer, mm-hmm. who was on loan to the CIA from German intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and his father Gunther Strassmeyer was a big mover and shaker over in Germany, considered to be one of the architects of German reunification. But here's the important part. Okay, Christian identity, which was what Robert Millar's theology was. Reverend Millar is no longer with us. He's dead. And what the religion, the shared religion of Elohim City, Christian identity has a lot of UFO elements in it. And when he was looking into the JFK assassination, Garrison looked into a network of Christian identity churches as being possibly involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And one of the individuals involved in both Christian identity and the Kennedy assassination was an intelligence agent by the name of Fred Chrisman. Now that's where the nexus. Now that's where the nexus meets with the whole UFO deception.
Didn't Guy Chrisman, Bannister? Wasn't Guy Bannister also linked to UFO sightings?
Yes. He was head of what basically were the real life X-Files.
Yeah.
But Chrisman, Fred Chrisman, was the individual who manufactured the Murray UFO incident, where I can't remember how many, five or six UFOs were a damaged UFO flew
was flying over Murray Island and dumped some fragments, killed a person's dog and injured his son with burns and whatnot. And the fragments were, you know, the alleged fragments from that UFO were in Chrisman's possession and all. So, you know, here's Fred Chrisman. He's connected to all these Christian identity, churches that are in turn connected to the intelligence community. And he's also manufacturing one of the most famous UFO incidents in the history of ufology. So again, you have this this nexus there between the UFO myth and intelligence operations and just everything that we would call deep politics.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier how there is a racial component
mm-hmm.
that seems to be intrinsic to the promulgation of the alien myth. Well, that racial component becomes evident with none other than the late Professor John Mack, who basically proposed that abductees descended from an entirely different genetic pool than the rest of us. And John Mack, I might add, was funded by the Rockefellers. Right. And Mack basically characterized the abduction experience as a spiritual one that produced this very special breed of humans whose parentage was from space or even perhaps another dimension. And they constituted an entirely distinct bloodline, an entirely distinct race, which represented the amalgamation of alien and human elements in some inexplicable way. But with that particular belief, you have once more a Gnostic belief being promoted, in particular a Manichaean belief. Of course, Manichaeanism was a Gnostic Persian religion, and it basically partitioned humanity off into two separate categories, one the category of light and the other the category of darkness. And so in this case, the abductee is portrayed as the pneumeticoi, the truly spiritual man, and the rest of humanity who hasn't been blessed with the opportunity to be probed anally by these visiting space brethren, well, they happen to be the dirty, filthy sukekoi. But Jacques Vallée has noted that with contactee philosophies, that there is this belief in higher races, that there is this belief in a chosen people, and that the extraterrestrial intervention has produced a higher race that really constitutes a new man. So there's this very eugenical element to the UFO mythos. And again, that is very expedient to the global oligarchical establishment.
Yeah. It's almost like a bloodline back to Christ, like the Merovingians or something, some rationalization.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, it just has something to do with like the myth of the nine, you know.
Puharich.
Yeah, these Boston Brahmin families that were channeled by alien spaceships or something.
Yeah. Well, they certainly factored in, because with the nine, you weren't just talking about fringe cult personalities. You were talking about some of the best families. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
the families, the Astors, and whatnot. I do know also that Phil was referring to, was just speaking about John Mack. Mack was not only funded by the by the Rockefellers. His legal defense when he was defending his research and at his work in a college setting and all was Daniel Sheehan of the Christic Institute. There's been what I would consider to be, I expect people throw barbs at me saying this, but I consider there to be substantial evidence that he intentionally did a poor job in terms of the Dave Sabo case where, you know, this Marine had discovered, you know, the drugs, the CIA drugs being flown into, I believe, El Toro Pongo Air Force Base, and that he had done a really bad job representing Martha Honey and her husband back during Iran-Contra, that he was intentionally losing these cases. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was the New World Foundation where Hillary Clinton had been a mover and shaker that was financing Sheehan's work. But then Sheehan also went on to act as legal counsel for the for Stephen Greer's disclosure movement. So, you know, you got these strange kind of connections here that suggest manipulation of the whole UFO field by intelligence circles.
Yeah, and of course Hillary Clinton, she's compromised because of the whole MENA connection.
Absolutely.
With Barry Seal and the Arkansas Development Corporation, which authority wrote, which is being used to launder some of the proceeds, which they were all getting their beaks wet in Arkansas.
Right. You know. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is, by the way, is suggested in American Made, because there's a scene in it where Barry Seal is being charged and he's dealing with the state attorney general and she gets a call from Governor Clinton and he's released. So there is some revelation. They're showing some leg there.
Right.
Because the implications are clear. Why would the governor be calling up of this cocaine dealer unless he has some sort of intelligence connections? But as far as the abductees, there's also another dimension here. There could be that a lot of these victims are just being experimented on and led to believe that they're being abducted.
Oh, absolutely!
You know, absolutely. And do you ever remember what was that couple that was abducted in one of the earlier cases? Do you remember
Betty and Barney Hill?
Yeah, Benny and Barney Hill. Now
they brought attention to themselves because they were a multiracial. They were a biracial couple. They were a black man and a white woman
at a time that was very rare.
When it was very rare.
So does that factor in?
Yeah, movers and shakers in the civil rights movement, which is instantly going to gain COINTELPRO attention.
Yeah,
and everything. Barney described their captors as "quote unquote" Nazis. Whenever in their testimony, you pick up on the humanity, the human features of these their abductors. They're wearing build caps. They're wearing uniforms with zippers on them.
There's very little in the narrative that they present to suggest that these are, you know, little green men. All of the descriptions are anthropomorphic, and you know, right down to zippers, which, mm-hmm. as friend Jay Dyer in one of our interviews said, quote unquote, but they're space zippers.
And also the reliance on documents to me is rather naive, right?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, any document can read. I can put anything in a document, date it and stamp it.
Right. Right. I mean, exactly. But, you know, all of the elements of their narrative really suggest more so
more so
it was a terrestrial based operation,
right?
And it seems to imply that there was some kind of post hypnotic suggestion to that added fantastical elements to it to distract away from, you know, they're wearing build caps and uniforms and there's just so much to suggest the humanity of their captors.
So maybe they were wearing just human skin. There are lizards underneath or something. Like,
they're even characterized at one point in the narrative as being Nazis.
Yes, they are. They're characterized as being Nazis,
maybe they're a paperclip. No.
Yeah, well, that's where I was going. That's suggestive in itself, because a lot of the technology that's associated with the UFO phenomena seems to have been in development by Nazis, that the Nazi scientists, Wernher von Braun, General Dornberger,
people that found
themselves over here and found themselves part of our space program.
And not to mention also the fact that there seems to be a very Aryan element to the alien mythos, apart from the fact that you have this constant binary opposition being posed, where you have the Numeticoi, which could be alien human hybrids or abductees, and then the Sukekoi being the rest of humanity, mm-hmm. which is basically afflicted by the archonic bondage of old beliefs, old political and religious beliefs. But additionally, you also have one particular alien archetype being advanced through the mythos is the Nord, who happens to be blonde hair, blue eyed, and white. You know, so there seems to be this Aryan element to the alien mythos.
Well, I think that one of the first places where the tall blonde appears, he's a Venusian that appeared to George Adamski, and George Adamski claimed to have spoke to this Venusian out in the desert. I believe it was in California, and there was a lawyer out of Cincinnati, I believe, and this lawyer wanted to bring suit against Adamski and claimed that he was committing fraud using the United States Postal Service because he was spreading his story through the mail, and suggested that there would be an excellent federal case against Adamski, and lo and behold, it's none other than Alan Dulles that threatens to bring an injunction if the case ever reaches court and everything.
So, why would he inject himself into the case? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the lawyers at the Central Intelligence Agency had told Dulles that there was an excellent case against Adamski, and that's when he threatened a court injunction. That's instantly when Dulles threatened a court injunction. And Henry Davidson again suggested that Dulles seemed to be at the center of the whole UFO deception, and had suggested that Adamski was something of an unwitting dupe who this whole encounter with a Venusian was manufactured by the CIA and for his benefit. Mm-hmm. It goes back to a terrestrial point of origin.
Well, this whole, I mean, the UFO meme or idea, obviously you've H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, but then with its adaptation to radio, 1938 with Orson Welles, as part of the Princeton Radio Project, and that appears to be a just a big test, not just how people react to it, but how would the public react to the spin in the media? Apparently it was exaggerated, and they were seeing how people would react not just to the hysteria, but also to the reports of hysteria.
The Princeton Radio Project money came through a Rockefeller organ, right? And the public reaction was examined by Hadley Cantrell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cantrell and the Princeton Radio.
And this was a study of mass communication for mass manipulation.
How right. And in the study itself, I don't have it in front of me, so I'll be paraphrasing loosely, but they said that typically one of the reactions was to seek solace in some higher authority. So in this case, who could possibly promise, you know, some sort of protection against the Martians? Well, it would probably be the omnipotent state.
Yes.
And in H.G. Wells' book, which I don't want to open the H.G. Wells can of worms. Good grief! He was a Fabian socialist. He was a member of the Coefficients Club, which was preoccupied with war. One of its members was Leo Maxey, who promoted war with Germany well in advance of the First World War. Mm-hmm. H.G. Wells' book, which is basically a commercial for natural selection, and again, natural selection being part and parcel of the Gnostic myth of Darwinism, which provides the foundations for this alien mythos. And by the way, Richard Dawkins has entertained panspermia as well. So we can't consider God a tenable hypothesis for the human origins, but we can certainly entertain the notion of extraterrestrial gods. At any rate, War of the Worlds, at one particular point in the novel, H.G. Wells writes that the Martians had underestimated humanity's ability to unite itself. Mm-hmm. And that I think H.G. Wells says, and I'm paraphrasing him loosely, I don't have the novel in front of me, but he says, you know, did they not realize we were organized? Did they not realize we could come together, that we could unify? You know, and this is really, again, the rationale underpinning the perpetuation of this myth. You have an excellent rationalization for globalism,
monoculture, dictated from above, the destruction of all distinctions, differences, not just cultural but also sexual.
The promotion of this Gnostic belief in absolute human plasticity, the annihilation of all determinants of human identity, the homogenization of humanity into one monistic mass, which really, again, amounts to nothing more than an emanatized version of the Gnostic pleroma, this divine singularity from which man descended and to which man must return, unless, of course, he's not one of the pneumaticoi, in which case he's consigned to the cosmic dustbin.
Mm-hmm. And this was in the 1970s, everyone was saying, we're all Keynesians now. I guess you could say, we're all Gnostics now. Just don't know.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And, I mean, just look at chronology here. The beginning of the UFO scare, invaders from Mars, these things became popularized. The whole Area 51 and out there, what's it called again? That base?
Out in the desert. S-4.
Yes. Yeah.
S-4 that's part of the facility.
But Roswell. The Roswell incident, which is 1947, right? 1947?
Right.
Well, that's...
Or also the quote unquote new Area 51, which would be Dugway Proving Ground, which actually factors into the whole Jonestown massacre, because I believe that the father of the individual who ended up assassinating Leo Ryan on his way into the when he arrived at the landing field, mm-hmm. was a scientist at Dugway Proving Ground.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow. Another intelligence or CIA related cult, the people.
Absolutely.
And of course, that also factors into the murder of Mayor Moscone and Harvey Milk by that
right.
guy. I'm just saying it's 1947. This is the beginning of the national security state, the Cold War, and this goes back to your original thesis. This is a deception, a smokescreen for various covert operations and intelligence operations and secret military operations.
I do want to say that it's a smokescreen. There's a deception there, but I don't want to. I don't completely rule out the possibility of something otherworldly being involved, although I do not mean extraterrestrial or alien in the sense that people within the UFO field believe it. There are several occultists that seem to be wrapped up in the deception. Colonel John B. Alexander.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Harold, remote viewer Harold Putoff. Mm-hmm. Colonel Michael Aquino.
Yeah.
What that suggests to me is that in order to give an air of authenticity to the deception, these personnel have been brought in to summon things up, and what they're summoning up is alien in the sense that it's non-human, but it's not alien in the sense that it's from across the universe.
It's essentially black magic, conjuring.
Yes, exactly. That's where I was going, and that's
John D.
If that hypothesis holds, that should scare the hell out of everyone, because these people are trying to use use otherworldly forces to whom they cannot dictate the terms of the agreement. They don't dictate terms to the diabolical. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, it's a difference. A prayer is a petition. Black magic is an order.
And
from what I understand, it doesn't turn out well for those who practice it or for the people around them. And I think that's it's kind of like the difference in Faustus, right, where he gets dragged into hell for his magic
But all the while he has been led by the devil to believe that he's firmly in control of this.
Mm-hmm.
If the hypothesis I'm entertaining here is true, then the tail is wagging the dog. Alexander Putoff and Aquino might believe that they're firmly in control of the begin to do these invocations or whatnot, but the entities that they're pulling from elsewhere are really the ones that dictate the terms. They're in no position to dictate the terms to the diabolical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I may add very, very quickly, I'm not even going to
tried to broach this topic. Maybe we can for a later interview. And I actually broached this in my article, The Mythmakers of Modernity, which is also up at Conspiracy Archive. And actually, I expanded that article into an entire chapter of the forthcoming book, Invoking the Beyond. But the hermeneutic that governs the alien mythos, okay, the entire hermeneutic can be traced back centuries. And I actually trace it back to John Wilkins, who was a Royal Society member. And again, the Royal Society being one of the chief promulgators of Darwinism. John Wilkins was influenced by a Renaissance philosopher and astronomer, Giordano Bruno. And in turn, Bruno was an advocate of the ideas of Nicholas Cusa, who was a theologian who in De Dulce Ignoratia endorsed the idea of other inhabited worlds as early as the mid-15th century. But Nicholas of Cusa anticipated the Darwinian notion of evolutionary advantageous adaptations. So really, this the whole notion of natural selection, it wasn't novel. It didn't originate with Charles Darwin. Really originated with these older philosophers. But Bruno argued that the cosmos was just filled with inhabitable worlds, and that the universe was casa sui, or entirely self-sufficient, self-generating. So in essence, he bestowed deific attributes upon the physical universe and made of it this pantheistic organism. But Wilkins, who was influenced by Bruno, pinned his thoughts on moon travel in a book titled Discovery of a World in the Moon. And he also intimates this casa sui notion of the cosmos in his subtitle, which was A Discourse Tending to Prove That 'Tis Probable There May Be Another Habitable World in That Planet. And as this subtitle suggests, Wilkins shared Bruno's belief that the universe's ubiquitous generative processes could render other planets habitable. But meanwhile, you also have Royal Society members such as William Durham, who wrote the 1715 book Astrotheology, and in that book he basically states that other planets are habitable, that the self-generated universe has extended its pantheistic branches to those other worlds and has spawned from their primordial soups other species. And basically, Durham, what you find with his work is the transposition of elements of Christian eschatology into the immanent sphere, more specifically the situating of heaven and hell among various other planets of the universe. And according to Durham, the very existence of extraterrestrial life stipulated the revision of Christianity to accommodate this cosmic challenge. But you also have another one of the chief Enlightenment theoreticians and a self-avowed Gnostic himself, albeit a relatively new Gnostic by the name of Jacob Alevi. He advanced his own brand of Gnosticism this human creation myth, where he depicts Earth as a hell created for Lucifer and his fallen angels, and these celestial beings are subsequently transplanted into human bodies, which Alevi derisively dubs places of confinement, which sounds vaguely familiar to the same sort of Xenu myth that's advanced by Scientology.
And it sounds vaguely familiar to
Jim Jones what he was teaching, where he said that all these other planets were socialist paradise and Earth was kind of a the only way that they could get back to those socialist paradises on other worlds is if they brought about revolutionary changes here on Earth.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But it's with Alevi and Durham's theologized view of space that you find the proximate origins of the overall hermeneutic of the alien space religion. And I make that case to a certain extent in my article, The Mythmakers of Modernity, and in the forthcoming book, it's actually fleshed out further. So, long way around the barn, this is not a recent innovation. This can be traced back centuries.
And I think it's important to point out that many of those participants were Royal Society members. The Royal Society, basically a front for Freemasonry, and Freemasonry, unfortunately, at various times in history, acting as a conduit for elites,
right?
Acting as a conduit for the oligarchs,
and it's no coincidence that the Royal Society also was one of the chief promulgators of Darwinian evolution, which provided an excellent rationale for colonial warfare, genocide. Basically, it undergirded the mystical imperialist milieu of the British Empire. And of course, it's from the British Empire, in particular the Royal Institute of International Affairs, that we have the Council of Foreign Relations emerging, and the overall infrastructure of the global oligarchical establishment as it exists today.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Excellent. That's right. That's right. It's Darwinism was promoted not because of what it revealed in terms of explanatory power and for the natural order of things. It was there to rationalize the British Empire, to rationalize the carnal and earthly ambitions of the men who ran the British Empire. And
absolutely, it was advanced because of its anthropological propositions.
Mm-hmm.
And again, inherent to Darwin, the favorite races. Yeah. Well, inherent to Darwinism, exactly. Inherent to Darwinism is a Gnostic binary opposition, where in Gnosticism you have the noumenikoi and the psychikoi. In the secular theodicy of Darwinism, you have the fit and the unfit.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it justifies everything. Yeah. You know.
Absolutely.
Exploitation, misery, revolutions, the wars and all that. And of course, the Gnosticism, I guess when they took over the lodges in the 1720s, it became sort of this Freemasonry became a weapon for the British Empire for subversion and intrigue in the areas they were interested in, whether it's North America, Europe, Asia, so. Yeah.
Well, as has been pointed out by I can't recall their names, Gould and who else?
Fitzgerald and Gould.
The mystical imperialists were seeking to create this syncretistic religion, and one of the inspirational sources from which they cribbed liberally was Masonry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was all in the name of creating a kind of syncretistic religion that would unite the various factions of the empire and bring them together. So,
well, Masonry isn't all bad. My son's Little League team is sponsored by the local lodge. So,
oh no, I mean, one of our grandparents was Eastern Star when she was a child, and it didn't move on into anything else or develop into anything else when she entered adulthood and all. But
my son's number is 33 though. No, I'm joking.
but
But if you were to ask our grandmother, about masonry, she couldn't tell you any of this stuff. Which
she was very circumspect.
With like a porch brethren or something, you know.
Yeah, and that culture of obscurantism really predisposes itself to these clandestine agendas. It becomes an excellent conduit for elitist interest.
Mm-hmm.
by virtue of its secrecy.
Yeah, the vast majority of its participants have no idea what's going on at whatsoever.
Rings within rings.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Degrees of initiation. It's not Christian baptism where you're brought in and you're also brought into the fullness of the revelation of Jesus Christ. You're brought in by degrees, and slowly as it's determined that you can be trusted, more of the secret is entrusted to you. And I believe it was Albert Pike that said that the Blue Lodges were mere porticos, just mere mm-hmm. windows into a world that was so much larger than just those mere, you know, those mere minor Blue Lodges.
Yeah. Now, Albert Pike, the only Confederate general that has a monument in Washington, D.C., and it's not being taken down.
It's not being taken down. Ain't that something?
Yeah. Tear down Robert E. Lee, but leave up Albert Pike.
Lee has gone Stonewall Jackson, and he was an overrated general anyways, blah, 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 and all that. But nobody seems to say word number one about, you know.
If I'm not mistaken, I think in Robert E. Lee's own writing, you will find denunciations of slavery. You will find no such denunciations in Albert Pike's work.
No.
He was not fond of black people. So... But at any rate, to be fair though, because I don't want to fall into the worst excesses of conspiracy theory, but to be fair with Freemasonry, much of the Gnostic elements that you find in Freemasonry, much of what is derivative of the ancient mystery religion from 2,000 years ago in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, what you find there is still not even really – it's only a vague echo of what it was because it was heavily reformulated. And, the Freemasons in the formulation of their outlook they approached it much like a salad bar,
mm-hmm.
you know, they themselves being syncretist. And so it's difficult to tell where, you know, the actual Gnostic beliefs begin and the actual mystery religions begin and end and the Freemasonic revisions begin.
Yeah, well, it's that pragmatism, I think.
Right. And I'm not exonerating Gnosticism. Again, I share the of course, as an Orthodox Christian, I hold to the critique of Gnosticism inherent to my own theology, and also I share the pagan critique of Gnosticism, which was advanced by the Neoplatonist Plotinus.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Gnosticism stands condemned on its own merits. But my point is that if you look to Freemasonry to learn something about that, you're not looking to a great source.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of heavy embellishment with them, and again, it's kind of like what Egg Shin said in Big Trouble in Little China when he's talking to Kurt Russell's character, Jack Burton. He says, you know, well, of course, you know, Chinese religion is a mess. Look at what we have to work with. You know, we have Taoism, we have Confucianism, and he's like, but we go out, we find these beliefs, we take what we like and leave the rest, just like your salad bar. And that's in essence what you have with Freemasonry, is just
this absolute bastardization of a great many outlooks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and it's fitting for an empire, isn't it? So,
oh, absolutely, yeah. Because it's whatever is taken and whatever is left behind is based on what lends itself to that control agenda that we were talking about at the very beginning.
Funny thing is, very much like American culture, but I won't go there right now. So. There's a connection there, perhaps. I don't know. So,
oh God.
Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank you, both of you, Paul and Phil. The article is The Alien Smokescreen. You can read that at Conspiracy, right? What's the website again?
Conspiracy Archive.
We give that out.
Yeah, maintained and owned by Terry Melanson, who, of course, also authored the book Perfectibilist, which is perhaps one of the best books over the 18th century, Illuminati. Absolutely no sensationalism, and he draws from some incredible primary sources that he had to dig up for that. So,
And, of course, you both are the authors of The Ascendancy, The Science of a Dictatorship, and your forthcoming book is Invoking the Beyond.
Absolutely.
Which will be done next week, right? I'm joking.
If only. It's setting at 660 some pages right now, and we're able to blaze a trail, and then we have to leave it, and then, like, you know, there'll be a period of time where days on end are just spent writing, and then all of a sudden work and other obligations calls us away, and then it just sits there, just untouched.
Yeah. In all seriousness, we are hoping to have it out by early this next year. We are tying up most of the loose ends. We're bringing chapters to a close. And hopefully we'll have it all arranged and ready to go as one coherent book sometime early next year. So it won't be out in time for Christmas, but, you know,
what we're hoping that the final product is going to be is a book that doesn't just get read once, that it's something like what you would expect from an E. Michael Jones,
yeah,
or some researcher of that caliber, where you can go back and you can read this book a second and third time and find something new each and every single time. Mm-hmm. So that's what we hope the final product is going to be, and that's what we've really worked towards with this.
Well, good things take time, so
yeah, so,
especially when you have to have an honest job. So,
oh, absolutely, yep.
So, listen, thank you both. I'll let you go. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Yeah, you do the same.
We'll talk again in the near future, and enjoy your vacation, your trip. Have a safe trip. And
thanks.
And so, let you go. And yeah, I'll post this in a few days. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Sounds good. Yeah. Sounds good. Hey, okay. Thanks again.
Take care then. Bye bye.
Hey, bye.
Last morning that I wake up in this dirty city, looking for the sunshine as the buildings block the skies. This is the last morning that I wash in rushed water, try to shave a face that I don't even recognize. Down the hallway, rats are skidding. I can smell the garbage rotting. Hear the children crying in apartments down below. This is the last morning that I'm gonna have to listen to it. I'm going home. Try to breathe the heavy air. by the crowd to pour the traffic, watch the world turn gray. This is the last morning that I drink my coffee stand. Smile and speak to strangers, just turn and walk away. This is a tough, cold city, and I guess I'll never cut it here. I'm so tired of trying to stand against it all alone. This is the last morning, and I'm gonna have to fight it. I'm going home. This is the last morning that I wear these greasy overalls, punch the clock and do I'm told to get along and face the long evening right close beside my radio, imagining the kisses of the girl who sings a song. Down below the subway screaming as I lie here halfway dreaming, looking at the ceiling wondering where I'm going home.